Welcome to Keeping Up. This is week 19. This is Clay, the overcrowded Smith.
This is Jim. I'm done with the swine flu fictal.
Listen, we're so glad that the swine flu is turning out to not be as bad of an actor as we thought it was going to be. This is week 19, Keeping Up, This Week in Journals. This is a CME offering for Vanderbilt University. On your screen right now should be the disclosure statement. You need to read that. Then you can get your CME credit. Just go to keepingupnem.com and get your credit today. So we've got 10 for you this week. So we're going to go ahead and get started.
All right. First up is Betterson et al. Guidelines for the Management of Aneurysmal Subarachnoid Hemorrhage, a statement for healthcare professionals from a special writing group of the Stroke Council, American Heart Association, published in Stroke, March 2009. Subarachnoid hemorrhage accounts for approximately 5% of all strokes and affects about 30,000 Americans per year. Mortality reaches as high as 45%. These are the recommendations from the American Heart Association regarding the treatment of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage. So these are guidelines that are based on several questions, and really what's pertinent to us, it will be summarized. So prevention of subarachnoid hemorrhage, treat high blood pressure, stop smoking. Pretty straightforward. The natural history and outcome of subarachnoid hemorrhage is highly dependent upon the initial amount of blood at their presentation. So don't miss sentinel bleeds. Diagnosis, get a non-contrasted head CT scan, and then also perform a lumbar puncture if the CT is negative. Stay tuned for more studies that evaluate CT angio as well as MRAs. Medical measures to prevent rebleeding, there's no distinct guidance given, but control high blood pressure. And also, as far as systems issue goes, consider a transfer to a high volume center. Medical management of the cerebral vasospasm, oral nimodipine has class 1 evidence, while other calcium antagonists are incompletely studied, so stay tuned. Seizure, considered prophylactic anticonvulsant immediately post-hemorrhage. So how does this apply to our practice? Generally, this is not groundbreaking information, but there's several important updates since 1995. Treat the hypertension, encourage people to stop smoking, utilize calcium antagonists, and don't miss sentinel bleeds.
This is amazing because Jim's distilled this to little over 180 words, and this is a 33-page article. He's really just included the stuff that is pertinent to the ED. If you happen to do endovascular coiling, you might want to take a look at this article. And we've got the hyperlink to the full text on our written summary. So go to the website, keepingupinem.com, and check it out.
Sure, the operation versus coiling was quite enthralling.
You know, I'm trying to cut down on the amount of endovascular coiling that I'm doing in the ED.
That's right.
Well, next up, we've got Chang et al., Delayed Administration of Antibiotics and Mortality in Patients with Community-Acquired Pneumonia. This is in Annals of Emergency Medicine, May 2009. Well, the Joint Commission has set 4 hours as the magical time for antibiotic administration in pneumonia, but prior studies have been inconclusive as to whether this actually decreases mortality. This was a prospective cohort study of 501 pneumonia patients. Many of these were elderly, hypoxic, hypotensive, and had a pneumonia severity index of 4 or 5. 69% of the patients received antibiotics within the magical 4-hour window, 91% within 8 hours. The time to antibiotics was shorter in patients that had high-risk features, and it was shorter in patients who died. Early antibiotic administration was associated actually with worse outcome. It was inversely associated with mortality and not at all associated with increased length of stay. Now, the limitations were, this was a relatively small study compared with the Medicare database studies that had been done before. It was single center, and the observational design really can't prove causality. I think the application to practice, I don't think that early antibiotic administration is killing people. I mean, that's kind of what the study would suggest. It's inversely associated with mortality, because it's known that hypotensive septic pneumonia patients benefit from early antibiotics. I think the point of this study is that early antibiotics, that is within that 4-hour window, are a poor measure of hospital quality. In less severe pneumonia patients, it really likely makes little difference whether patients are treated within 4 hours or not. This JCO requirement of getting antibiotics within 4 hours to say you're a good or a bad ED or a hospital, I think is bunk. And I think this study actually shows that early antibiotics, people die quicker. But it's not because of the antibiotics or not. It's because they have a worse case of pneumonia.
Exactly. I think we do a good job of recognizing who's sick, and we definitely get antibiotics in those people sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, the sicker they were, the quicker they got antibiotics. But the sicker they were and the quicker they got antibiotics, the more of them died. It was because they had a bad case of pneumonia, not because it was a delay in antibiotics.
Exactly. Next up is Chinkin et al., predictive value of the Ontario Prehospital Stroke Screening Tool for the identification of patients with acute stroke, published in Prehospital Emergency Care, April-June 2009. Time is brain when it comes to stroke care. Several prehospital tools have been developed, including the Cincinnati Prehospital Stroke Scale and the Los Angeles Prehospital Stroke Screen. This group wanted to study the Ontario Prehospital Stroke Screening Tool that included a time limit of 2 hours after symptom onset. So the results of this study, this was a retrospective review of patients transported to a regional stroke center in Toronto. Ontario screening included usual items such as unilateral arm or leg weakness, slurred or inappropriate words, or being mute, and facial droop with the ability to transport within 2 hours of symptom onset. The exclusion criteria were the usual mimics, hypoglycemia, seizure, and also included terminally ill or palliative care patients. 325 patients met criteria and 229 did not. Sensitivity for acute stroke was 89%, with a positive predictive value of 89.5%. The rate of TPA administration doubled to 10%. Now, limitations of the study is that it's an unknown miss rate. So, you know, it does include people who transferred to other centers, and they didn't really take all comers for this. So you really don't know exactly what the sensitivity and specificity may be with this screening tool. Now, how does this apply to our practice? The Ontario system is just another tool that you utilize pre-hospital to help predict who has acute stroke and who might meet TPA administration. So just really make sure that your local EMS system has a screening system in place and are actually utilizing it.
We find that if we get some pre-hospital heads up on a patient that's coming in, we can open up the CT scanner, get them in there quicker, and they're definitely more likely to get treated, whether you believe in TPA or not. So next up, Kanagaya et al. This is recognition of Kawasaki disease shock syndrome in pediatrics, May 2009. So crash and burn. This is a good mnemonic for Kawasaki. Conjunctivitis, rash, adenopathy, strawberry tongue, hand and feet desquamation, and burn, fever greater than 5 days. So crash and burn is a great way to remember Kawasaki. Now, some kids who have Kawasaki disease develop shock, and these authors in San Diego sought to find predictors. The results were 13 patients ended up with shock that had Kawasaki. 174 did not develop shock in this four-year study period. Predictors of shock were female gender, higher inflammatory markers, lower hemoglobin and platelet counts, consumptive coagulopathy, impaired ejection fraction, less than 54% on echo, in presence of diastolic dysfunction, also resistance to IVIG, that is fever persistent greater than 36 hours. And these kids more often had coronary artery abnormalities, mitral regurgitation, and persistent diastolic dysfunction in follow-up. Now, the limitations, the numbers are too small to perform multivariate analysis and find independent predictors. So the application, really, I just wanted to do this article to put this disease on the map because, personally, I had never heard of Kawasaki disease shock syndrome. Had you, Jim?
No, that's a new one for me as well.
I like to ride Kawasaki four-wheelers, but alas, I'd never heard of this disease entity, so I wanted to make you aware of it, and I wanted to make me aware of it, which was the problem was it was increasing in incidence during the study period. They were finding more and more cases of Kawasaki disease associated with shock, so I think we need to know what kids are at higher risk for this, and it just puts it on the map. So welcome to a new disease.
Thank you. Next up is Morris et al., anesthesia in hemodynamically compromised emergency patients. Does ketamine represent the best choice of induction agent? Published in Anesthesia, May 2009. So RSI generally involves an induction agent, most commonly used as etomidate, and a paralytic. But should we be using etomidate? There's lots of questions about etomidate with adrenal suppression, which we won't go into. And is there something better? So this is a review article touting the benefits of ketamine, including in the following cases. Brain injury. It might increase ICP, but it actually maintains cerebral blood flow better than etomidate by maintaining the mean arterial pressure better. Clearly, in hypotensive patients, it's more stable with ketamine. Now, the limitations is this is a review article only. Now, application to what we do, ketamine is fairly safe to use even in head-injured patients and really should be considered in the hypotensive patient with a head injury because it may increase ICP, but it certainly has less effect on mean arterial pressure than etomidate. But we certainly need more studies to prove this out.
I mean, ultimately, what it's going to take is a head-to-head trial where people just look at different induction agents and their role, because you know you can see advantages to using ketamine. It's going to be a great induction agent, but what is it going to do to ICP? We know it's probably going to go up, but does it matter? Does it affect mortality?
Exactly.
We kind of brought this up just to poke a skunk, you know, I mean, just to ring up the whole what's the best induction agent in the RSI. It's a good review article. Check it out. Next up, O'Malley et al. Routine packing of simple cutaneous abscesses is painful and probably unnecessary. Academic Emergency Medicine in April 2009. So to pack or not to pack, that is the question.
Very poetic.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous iodoform or in opposing, take it out. I don't know. Results, 48 patients were enrolled in this single-blinded randomized trial of packing versus no packing in simple abscesses that is less than 5 centimeters in size. All these patients received a prescription for narcotics, trimethoprim / sulfamethoxazole, and were followed up at 48 hours, or at least they were supposed to be. 4 patients in the packing group required intervention at follow-up. That is, they had a repeat pack, something like that, versus 5 in the non-packing group. And the p-value was not significant. Pain, rated on a visual analog scale, was worse immediately after incision and drainage and at 48-hour follow-up in the group that got packing into the abscess cavity. And the group that got packing used more narcotic pain medication. Now, the limitations. This is a pilot study only. They did not do sample size or power calculation. The other big problem is a third of the patients didn't return at 48 hours for follow-up. And more in the non-packing group didn't come back. Now, you might say, well, they didn't come back because they didn't have any problem. Well, we don't know that. The application, don't change your practice on the basis of a pilot study like this. But if this is proven, it may challenge a long-held dogma about abscess care and the use of gauze packing in these wounds. It seems to hurt more. I mean, shocker. But then again, is it going to hurt more if you don't pack it and you have to go back in and bluntly probe it again?
Exactly. This brings up some good questions, but stay tuned for more studies.
Next up, Lee et al. Reversal of profound neuromuscular block by Segamidex administered 3 minutes after rocuronium. This is a comparison with spontaneous recovery from succinylcholine. This is in Anesthesiology, May 2009. Segamidex is a very cool molecule that surrounds and inactivates rocuronium in about 90 seconds. There's a prior report that we've done here in Keeping Up that described a phase 2 trial. So go to our website, keepingupneum.com, and check it out. The results, this was a randomized safety assessor blinded clinical trial comparing succinylcholine at 1 mg per kilogram with spontaneous recovery to rocuronium 1.2 milligrams per kilogram, followed by a dose of Segamidex at 16 mg per kg, given 3 minutes after the paralytic was given. And the outcome measure was return of the first train of 4 muscular twitch to 10%. But what I'm going to look at is the return of the first muscular twitch to 90%. And this was 10.9 minutes when patients were allowed to spontaneously recover from succinylcholine versus only 6.2 minutes for the rocuronium Segamidex group. And this was highly statistically significant. What this means is the reversal time from the time the Segamidex was given was just under 3 minutes. There were no significant differences in adverse events between the two groups. Now, I think the limitations, this is not really a fair comparison because a trial has already been done that shows that Segamidex reverses rocuronium really fast. The study also was supported by Sharing Plow, makers of Segamidex, and their biostatistician did the stats. So take it with a grain of salt, but it does appear from this study and other prior studies that rocuronium can be rapidly reversed with Segamidex, and it may soon become our drug of choice for rapid sequence intubation if Segamidex is approved as a reversal agent by the FDA. It has some potential, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It may be one of those drugs that are like, oh, my goodness, what have I just done to try to intubate this patient? Dear Lord, where's the sugar mama dex?
The sugar mama dex. Sugar mama dex.
I need some help. All right. Next up is Moskop et al. ED carotid parts 1 and 2, published in Annals of Emergency Medicine, May 2009. So what these papers tried to do was they wanted to define what ED crowding is and what can we do about it. This is something we all deal with really on a daily basis. Now, these are two review articles discussing these topics to give it a clearer picture. And I've tried to summarize these two articles. So first, ED crowding. There is no consensus definition. pretty helpful. But I think it occurs when patient numbers and really the needs of those patients exceed your available resources. Causes are multiple and include increased patient volume, not the patients that present, but it's the lack of places to put admitted patients. It's more of an output issue. Moral consequences include increased risk of harm to patients, delays in needed care, compromised privacy. So to your hallway patient, have you ever had gonorrhea? How about HIV? And really diminished access to care. Now, operational strategies that were proposed. Multidisciplinary teams, great, more meetings to collect data and analyze the problem. Bed management problems. The one I really like is the beds are upstairs. We all have charge nurses and flow nurses that do a great job of getting patients out and make sure rooms are clean. Why not take that upstairs? And then evaluating your ED peak flow and compare that to the elective surgery times. Maybe if everyone gets admitted from the ED on Mondays, maybe you shouldn't schedule as many elective surgeries on Monday.
Wow.
Well, it's enticing, yeah. And OBS units are an option. And moving our hallway patients to inpatient hallways, essentially spreading the love. I mean, the burden of admitted patients.
I like it. Share the love.
So now, financial barriers to ED crowding. We allow the hospital to be at full capacity. Our patients don't bring in cash like elective surgeries. This also limits our legal duty to care for everyone that enters because we have to end up going on diversion. And our patients are captive. They're already here. Financial strategies for this, well, you can ask Congress for money to reimburse hospitals to provide uncompensated emergency and trauma care. Maybe there could be a type of TARP plan for the ED crowding. Maybe call it CARP.
As Huckabee said, the Congressional Relief Action Program. Crap.
Yeah, crap. That'd probably work out. And really, trying to end boarding and ambulance diversion. So how does this apply to what we do? Overall, these are good articles that you should read. This was just a highlight discussing a problem that we deal with day in and day out, except for most weekends, holidays, and spring breaks when the surgeons are on vacation.
I'm telling you, crowding is a huge issue. We all know it. The other day, we had a hip fracture, an elderly hip fracture, in a wheelchair in the hall. We were treating a DKA case on the stretcher in the hall on an insulin infusion, and we had gotten cardiac biomarkers and ordered a stress test, all on a patient still technically in the waiting room. It's a huge issue, and it's a good couple of articles in the Annals just to check this out and to say, here's some strategies that you can use with your hospital administrators. Speaking of overcrowding, this is another article in that same issue by Kari et al. Adding more beds to the emergency department or reducing admitted patient boarding times. Which has a more significant influence on emergency department congestion? What do you think the answer to this title is going to be? This was in Annals of May 2009.
Behind door number two.
Yeah, exactly. You know what the answer is. No surprise. This was a computer model that tried several different scenarios, and they found that if ED beds increased, then shocker, length of stay would increase by 7 minutes. They found that increasing admitted patient outflow to inpatient beds, that is decreasing ED boarding, would decrease length of stay by 22 minutes. Now the limitations, this was a computer model based on assumptions, which if they're incorrect, your whole study goes down the tubes. But they did multiple sensitivity analyses to try different inputs and different scenarios, different assumptions. And they think they have a good model here, but I'm just saying, who needs a model? Because our experience here at Vanderbilt is that our ED doubled in size in 2005, and Dr. Jin Han, Alan Storo, Dominic Aronsky, some guys here at Vanderbilt researchers, found precisely what their model predicted in real life. That is, if ED beds increase, we doubled in size, then our length of stay increased dramatically, and our ambulance diversion didn't change. It's because we become a parking lot. We're the ward unit south now on the first floor.
Oh, yeah. One south, as I like to call it. If you build it, they will come. But unfortunately, they don't go upstairs after they get to the ED.
If you build it, they will come and they will stay.
Yes.
The application ED crowding is not an ED problem only. And this paper just lends more credence to that assertion. All right, this is Keeping Up This Week in Journals. We hope you've enjoyed this 10. Go to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and you can get your CME credit for this. And again, you need to see the CME disclosure statement that's at the beginning. It's also on our website. And you can also find other fun stuff there, old articles, the blog, and lots of great stuff, and a written summary that has all of these things written out. and it's got hyperlinks directly to Medline so that you can go to the article and read it for yourself. So thanks for listening, and tune in next week.
That's right. You guys have a good week, and keep on keeping up.
That is cheesy.
It's awesome.